Sarah to control, shrink to fit, program works, all systems go. We're in Mac's head. I repeat, we're in Mac's head. And no control, traversing up his nose was not as turbulent as we thought. All systems stable. It's the first mission for the good ship. ADPP's inaugural exploration is on its way.
I think I feel a headache coming on. Nearly finished episode 4. Maybe I'll stop this for a bit. Just lie down for a few seconds. Listen to a podcast.
Dang it, he's closed his laptop control. There's no chance of getting a peek of what he was writing now. Well, change of course, going straight for the brain now. We're stable again. Yes. Travelling up the final cortex now to the central cerebellum brain. Wow, control, you're not going to believe this, but there's like, it's like a small portal door up ahead. There's clumps of moss around it. It looks like there's a ticket machine next to it. How bizarre. Hang on, I'll just dock and explore. Oh, wow, there's neon blue pulses passing by so fast here. Got to be careful not to tread on them. It must be him working out his next plot line.
Welcome. Please, take a number. Someone will be with you shortly.
Don't call me shortly.
Please take a number. Please take a number. Please take a number.
Okay, I've got a number. I've got a number.
Someone will be with you in a short while.
Oh, thank you.
Shortly.
Boy, computer, why? Why do I have to wait?
Well, isn't it obvious? There's a queue.
For Max Break.
Uh-huh.
This number says, what's the symbol for infinity?
Exactly. You'll never get his writing secret. Never. Max defense cell, attack!
Welcome to the Audio Drama Production Podcast on the Audio Drama Network. I'm Mac Rogers.
And I'm Sarah Golding, and I am so excited to be chatting to Mac Rogers, who, to be honest, Mac, you're one of my favourite writers of the moment. I think the last year or two, I've been enjoying everything that you've turned out in your amazing style. And welcome to the programme, firstly.
Thank you so much for having me on it.
Superb. And come on, tell us, what are you working on right now?
What I can say about it is that I am writing a new 10-part audio drama series, and it's much more horror-inflected than science fiction. And I'm going to try to make it as scary as possible, and it's going to be a little bit of a stylistic departure from Life After and Steal the Stars, in that it'll be my first time attempting to work without a narrator.
The first question really for you is, why audio drama? What lures you to this wonderful medium of telling stories?
I'd been listening to audio drama for several years before I started writing it. My gateway was into audio drama was the Big Finish Doctor Who recordings, because I've been a Doctor Who fan since I was a little kid.
Yes.
And I started watching Doctor Who PBS reruns. They were, you know, in the early 80s, they were rerunning Fourth Doctor Tom Baker stories. And so ever since I was a little kid, I got obsessed with the show. And then
he's
of course,
my doctor,
of course,
Tom Baker, all the way.
Tom
I'm
Baker,
afraid.
Is that right? Yeah, definitely. Yes. Mine as well. So, you know, I discovered that this company, Big Finish, makes these audio dramas with original actors, like original actors who played the Doctor, original actors who played the Companions. They might not look the same, but they sound enough the same that they could make new adventures with them that were audio only. So I started listening to those, but then I found that, you know, I wanted more variety in what I was listening to. I discovered that there was a BBC Radio 4 podcast app in the United States. It's like a US podcast app that if you subscribe every Friday, it sends you a play that was broadcast on Radio 4. And then I started going on to Audible and looking for full cast dramas. It took me the longest time to figure out that that there were dramas being offered in the same way that nonfiction podcasts were being offered, through podcast platforms. When I was writing the message, they told me, I said, well, what style do you want this to be in? The Panoply people. And they said, go listen to Limetown and go listen to the Black Tapes podcast. We want it to be in that style.
So The Message and Life After and Steal the Stars are kind of ones I want to particularly mention. It's just being outstandingly fun to listen to. And the twists and turns and the characters and the whole cast members that you've got involved and the sound editing, all of the elements that you want for a really good listen are all there. So excellent work on your part.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Well, goodness, I couldn't say it. I can keep going, to be honest. but yes, do you have any like writing rituals? Are there things that you must do when you're about to sit down, or you've got an idea and a gem of idea from somewhere?
I find myself putting it off for any reason that I can think of, because I'm always convinced that the next time is the time I'm going to fall flat on my face. What my colleagues have eventually learned to do is to basically find ways of sort of shaming me into finishing scripts. Before I got into audio and I was writing all plays for theater, my colleagues learned to basically just go ahead and schedule a reading or schedule a rehearsal before the script was even done, so that I would absolutely have to finish it because I didn't dare show up without one. It's just that they've learned that there's no other way to get me to finish a script. I guess I don't have anything sort of super formal, but lately what I've found is that I really just need to write before I do anything else in the morning. What I've learned, though, is that if I start checking social media first thing in the morning, it puts my brain out into the world in a big way. It starts grinding the gears of kind of the aggravation machine inside my mind. That is, I really need to get up and write a few lines before I do anything else, so that starts my day off in a creative vein.
Yes, yes. So talk us through a typical writing day, would you?
You know, like if I wrote on more of a regular schedule, I'd get scripts done a lot faster. I sort of write very erratically. It's whatever time of day, or just simply when the work is past due and I just really need to churn it out fast. I definitely envy the writers I know who have set blocks of time during the day when they get stuff done. Interestingly, a number of writers I know who've had children in the last 5, 7, 8, 9 years, whatever, they have become very productive. Kind of counterintuitively, because for them, they can't tell themselves, oh, I'll write later today. I have a lot more time to write, but by the same token, sometimes that means that I squander it. I think I need to become much more regimented so that I can give better advice to people, and so I can have better answers for questions like this on podcast.
Well, no, to be honest, though, I wonder probably 99.9% of people nodding along to this saying, yeah. Because where's your favourite place to write and think then? Do you you do it spontaneously, so it happens outside in cafes and parks? And
since I started being able to write audio for a living, I have been able to work from home. So I've mostly just worked in my office in my apartment where I live with my wife, Sandy. For one thing, it's a huge savings, and no one's watching me to see if I'm getting work done. I'm doing other stuff instead of writing. So I have to force myself to, get out of the apartment and go somewhere. And sometimes when I really need to make sure that I get a thing done with no distractions, I just grab a pen and a spiral notebook, and I leave the house with just that. I go to a coffee shop with just a spiral notebook, because in a spiral notebook, I can't click over to Netflix. But by and large, I mostly write from home.
And so, yes, obviously a lot of people ask this question, I'm sure, but regards to any blocks that happen, sort of writer's block-wise, or you get to a point and things kind of aren't flowing, do you have any things that kind of help you to get out of those holes?
Partly it's that ever since I started writing to pay my rent, I just have to come up with something. When I'm really stuck, I know I just can't stay stuck. The best thing that I do, like in a situation like that, which I haven't dealt with in a little while, because Steal the Stars, Steal the Stars was a script I'd wanted to write for a long time, and I had a lot of my ideas were strongly in place early on, and I had so much fun writing that one that I didn't have a lot of I didn't get stuck very often on that project. But for example, Life After, that changed a lot in the course of its writing. There were definitely days when I was totally stuck and couldn't think of something. What I feel like when I'm stuck is it's not that I can't think of anything at all. It's that I can think of a bunch of things, but they all sound terrible to me. What I've learned to get myself out of the rut is just write one of the terrible ideas. Then we've all got something we can sit down and look at and figure out what to do with. Nothing's worse than not having a draft.
Just to peel the layers back of that for a moment. So you said, for example, you had Steal the Stars pretty much mapped out. Before you start your writing process, how much planning and preparation do you do on structure and plot and characters and so on before you even start to draft?
Outlines are really, really important to me. It's interesting, moving out of the world of theater and into the world of audio, I definitely run across more people who regularly use outlines. I definitely knew quite a large number of playwrights who they would get the basic idea for the play, they would get the basic idea for the characters, and then they would start writing the script not knowing where it was necessarily going to end. And they just sort of wanted to discover the story organically. I have never worked like that. I've always needed a point-by-point outline, and I need to know what ending I'm pushing toward. My make-or-break work occurs during the stage where I am outlining the script. That's where I'm making a lot of my good choices, or that's where I'm making a lot of my mistakes. Generally, I mean, there's a lot of work once the outline is done. You've got to write all those scenes. You've got to write all that dialogue. You've got to write all the sound effects, whatever. Knowing what marks I need to hit and knowing what ending I'm eventually pushing towards so that I understand why every scene is moving in that direction. Whenever I think of a line of dialogue or I think of a plot point or I think of a moment, I email it to myself. And I leave the email marked as unread until I've written it into the script. I take all those email subject lines and copy and paste them into a single document so I'll know to remember to include all of those points. What I like when I'm actually writing the scripts is I like to condense my overall outline for the series. I like to condense it into a single page. I can see how I'm progressing globally through the story. It keeps you focused on not falling into either of the two pitfalls you get when you're writing a serial podcast story, an episodic story. One is saving up most of the fun stuff for the beginning of the series and the end so that you've got these padded episodes in the middle. And then the other problem is just chewing up through your plot too fast so there isn't enough left over for later in the series. What you really need is to make sure that every episode is a complete piece of entertainment in and of itself. Every episode takes you further along in the story, but also every episode delivers a slam-bang piece of emotional, suspenseful entertainment so that it's like the episode doesn't just exist to move some pieces into place for the next episode. I think of it as treat distribution. I mean, you save some of your biggest treats for the end. You definitely need to have one of your most delicious treats in the first episode so people will keep going, but you really need to make sure that every episode, especially those doldrum episodes in the middle, are just as exciting as the beginning and the end.
You're not sure what's going to happen next, but you know it's going to be exciting.
That's so right. Bad. That's right. It's the danger of an age of serialized storytelling that we start treating individual episodes as just something to get us from point A to point B. The trip from point A to point B has got to be a good time every
single
episode.
It's all about the journey. Yeah. And with regards to writing then, so you've got the structure in place, how much time do you spend on developing your characters as well before you kick into gear?
I tend to find the characters as I go through the first draft and then I sharpen them considerably. I know ahead of time what the characters are doing in the plot. I know that from the outline. Because one crucial thing when you're writing dialogue is to make sure that the characters sound different from each other and make sure that they have different styles of talking. I kind of discover that as I go through the first draft. I'm sort of feeling my way through. When I go back to do the second, when I go back to do the first rewrite, I frequently find lots and lots that the characters are are really fuzzy and unfocused in the early episodes, mm-hmm. because I was still finding them. In the case of both Life After and Steal the Stars, I found that I was having to do considerably more massive rewrites on the earlier episodes than the later ones, because mm-hmm. by the time I got to the later ones in the first draft, I kind of knew what I was doing. The idiosyncrasies of the characters kind of come to me while I'm writing the first draft. Then mm-hmm. I need to go back and make sure that they're evenly applied and consistently applied throughout all the episodes of the story. Until the script is finished, there's a little part of me that just thinks I'm this guy at the bar talking about the novel he's working on that'll never get done. I can't make that feeling go away until mm-hmm. I get to the end of the first draft. You've got lots of stuff to fix. You never stop having things to fix, but you're fixing them with a whole new level of confidence. All of a sudden, this goes from being that thing you're talking about at the bar to a project that involves multiple people that will be produced in some form and distributed to an audience and will hopefully make a little money. Process for plotting out the series is, initially I have in the outline phase, I sort of figure out, the rough basics of how all the moving parts are going to work. Like I said, I try to keep it to one page so I don't get super intricate about it. And then as I go through the first draft, I kind of keep figuring out different things about the kind of micro plot mechanics. Like, for example, I knew from the very beginning that in Steal the Stars that Dak was going to smuggle the alien out in one of those coffins. But what I didn't know was how she was going to get a turned down box in that day and who she was going to be claiming would be in the turned down box. And then when I went back into the second draft, I was able to make all that stuff be a lot more smoothed out. One big thing about plotting is you're creating a fake sense that you're a plotting genius, because you take ideas that occurred to you quite late in the first draft, and then you're shifting them way earlier when you rewrite. Moss's body being warm in Steal the Stars. Mm-hmm. When I wrote the first draft of Steal the Stars, I didn't have that idea until episode 10, when mm-hmm. Dak was stealing the alien, and there was a moment where I had her warn Patty, oh, listen, before we move the alien, because they need to... Grant knocked the alien out of its chair, so they need to move Moss back into his chair. And Dak warns Patty, oh, before you touch him, you're going to be weirded out. His skin is warm. So that was an idea I came up with quite late in the writing process. I was like, wait a minute, that's got a big payoff at the end of the story. You know, the ending of the first episode is all about testing Matt to see how well he keeps his cool after he sees the alien. And then it occurred to me, what if Dak gives Matt one more test? What if she makes him touch the alien and see how badly he reacts when he feels that its skin is warm? So that way we introduce the warm skin in the very first episode, so that when it pays off in episode 14, then it's not some idea I just hurriedly slotted in there.
Yes.
Rewriting is for making you look like a genius when in fact you weren't really. I think in the podcast drama world, I think the pressure on the first episode is absolutely immense. Because the vast majority of podcasts are free, you know, either with ads or not with ads, but provided for free through podcast platforms. We don't even give people the feeling of, oh, you know what, I've already spent my money on this. I might as well watch it to the end. The podcast world is a whole bunch of us releasing episodes of our stories for free. And there are so many of them out there. And the podcast enthusiasts on Twitter, and I follow a lot of them, are recommending new stories and new series every day. Every morning I wake up and a half dozen podcasts have released new episodes. I have push notifications from a half dozen new episodes that have come down. It's amazingly difficult to keep up with all of them. And it's very easy to listen to one episode of a new one and then never come back to it because you have so many other ones to listen to. And everyone is overwhelmed with way more shows than they can possibly listen to. Mm-hmm. In a world like that, your first episode has to be a bullseye. There's an immense mm-hmm. amount of pressure on the first episode. The first episode has to clearly establish the concept of the show, mm-hmm. has to clearly give you a big personal situation that you're emotionally invested in, and has to leave you with a dynamite cliffhanger. I feel the squeeze writing first episode so bad. I know how easy it would be for a person to who has a packed phone full of podcasts to never come back to mine. So number one, you need a super cool concept. But number two, you need some kind of emotional yearning for your main character, because that's really what keeps people coming back. A love story or a friendship story or a family story or something like that. I obsess about cliffhangers. That's a big part of why outlining is so important to me. The cliffhangers at the end of every episode, they have to really make what people want to come back next week, but they also can't come out of nowhere. They need to feel organic to the story. And the further you go into the story, the more those cliffhangers need to aggravate people. You know, once you get past the halfway point of your podcast, if you're doing a limited series, once you get past the halfway point, your cliffhangers need to start making your audience furious. What I want is people giving their phone the middle finger on the street. I want people yelling at their own phone on the street. I want people who are following and know my Twitter handle, because I want that escalation to get people really involved in the story. And then beyond that, the cliffhangers have to vary. They can't all be a new piece of information. You have to mix it up. You have to do all different kinds. I remember how happy I was in Steal the Stars when I figured out that the cliffhanger to episode 12, that's the third to last episode in the whole series. Episode 12 was coming off a couple episodes that were all about the heist, and the episodes all ended with Dak and Matt in a place of big physical danger. Episode 12, the ending of that one is they pull into the driveway of this house that Dak doesn't recognize, and a woman comes out and kisses Matt.
Yes.
And I was like, I remember being so happy when I came up with that idea, because I was like, this is different than the last two or three cliffhangers. It's a whole different kind of cliffhanger. And this cliffhanger is going to work for me as a litmus test. If people are flipped out by this cliffhanger, that means they're invested in Dak and Matt, which is what the series absolutely needs to succeed.
Yeah, well, I think what really drew me in straight away in Steal the Stars was just the strength of character of Dak straight away. And, you know, I do think it's obviously the year of the women, as they say currently, and just to have such a strong and powerful, clear-minded character there. And then along the way, you obviously find out various bits of flaws that seem to be eked out for because of her circumstance. And yeah, I think it was really refreshing. I mean, how did her character come about? Why did you choose to make her character the sort of central focus, if you like?
A big part of it was I wanted to do something very different than I'd done on the previous show. That was the initial trigger, was with Life After. The whole mandate I set myself for the character in Life After was like, I want this guy to be an everyman to the point where it's scary. My rule was, up until the last episode, he's never allowed to handle being a thriller situation any better than I, Mac Rogers, would handle it, which would be really badly. I wanted him to be completely incompetent. I wanted him to be really bad at being the hero of an espionage thriller. So I wanted him to constantly be making rookie mistakes, because I wanted the audience to feel like this guy could die at any moment. With Steal the Stars, I wanted to go in completely the opposite direction, particularly because, like, I really wanted it to be a story of obsessive love, like in Life After, but approached from a very different vantage point. Let's make our main character, let's make her amazing at being in thriller situations. Let's make her an incredibly resourceful, smart, you know, person who's seen it all. She's absolutely good. She's good at everything in the world, except she's got this gap in her life. Never been head over heels in love. She, like, my whole theory about Dak is basically that she's doing love backwards. She rose through different kinds of ranks of the military and then private contracting organizations very quickly. She's had a lot of flings. What she's never had is 17-year-old love. She's never had the love that you have when you're like 16, 17 years old or something like that. You fall head over heels in love with somebody who's, you know, about that same age at school or in your neighborhood or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And you're convinced you're going to be with that person for the rest of your life. And it might even be a person who's really ill-suited to you, but because it's the first time, because it's that first time that you're in love and you don't have any experience of the world and you don't know what a long-term relationship would entail, and the love is absolutely kind of obsessive, Dak never had that before. Mm-hmm. And there's something kind of horrifying about the idea of falling in 17-year-old love when you're in your late 30s, early 40s. And she, I wanted it to be that the one thing that she's not good at is being in love like this. It completely messes with everything else. Her plan is really well thought out and really well executed. Her plan would have worked if she hadn't overestimated Matt Salem. If she didn't believe so strongly that he loved her back as much as she loved him. The one mistake she made is thinking that Matt was made of stronger stuff than he really was. Because she's so good at everything else about the plan worked. I wanted to create a story where the character who is really resourceful and good at being in a thriller would still have all kinds of problems. And then what it really established her voice for me was I wrote the pilot episode. I wrote the first episode, and me and my friends made a recording of it just to show Tor how it would work. We recorded the whole first episode in an evening. We got together a bunch of friends to be in it, and we asked Ashley Atkinson if she'd be willing to come over and play Dak. She liked the script, and she came over to do it. Her reading of the character was so brilliant immediately. I wrote the rest of the episodes after that recording. I had my memory of that recording to establish Dak's voice in my head going forward. Okay, that character that Ashley played that night in December, how would that character say this next line? But she wanted to do it badly enough, and we were able to come up with a good offer for her and everything. I was definitely really worried about it because I had built the character around her to a strong degree. We actually just recently, Tor released a retail version of Steal the Stars that you can buy as an e-bundle. It has it's a complete collection of the show without any commercials. And it includes some extras, it includes some interviews, and it includes a live prequel that we recorded a little while ago. But it also includes that pilot, and it includes that sloppy pilot we did that one night. And actually, a few of the actors who, you know, went on to do the show were Nima Jarabchi, who plays Matt. He was in that pilot as well. Becky Comtois, who plays Patty, she was in the pilot. Nat Cassidy, who played Lloyd the scientist. He was in it, but he was playing a different character. He was playing the sleazy guy at the bar. But we recast that role because we wanted Nat to play Lloyd when we recorded the show properly. We ended up completely re-recording episode one because, you know, we got new microphones. We had a better studio set up, everything like that. But that recording that quick and dirty pilot was very educational.
How active were you along the way once it was written and in production?
The vast majority of the actors were people that my director, Jordana Williams, and I had worked with before. We've been doing plays together for many years, going back to 2000. Since about 2005, Jordana has been directing most of my plays, the vast majority of my plays. And because of doing plays together for many years, we had built up a, you know, kind of a cadre of actors that we really liked. Jordana had directed Ashley in a Fringe Festival play, New York Fringe Festival, I think back in 2011, 2012, something like that. Becky Comtois, who played Patty, she and I have acted together in several of my plays. We have great fun acting together. She's one of my favorite actors, and I wrote the role of Patty specifically, imagining her playing it. Nima Jarabchi, who played Matt, you know, we worked with a bunch of times. And then, like, a bunch of the smaller roles, like, for example, Rosh, the guy who does the bio scan when you first go into Quilmarine.
Yes.
We had this wonderful actor, Brian Silliman, who's a really funny guy. He's exactly who I had in mind to be the guy who tells the terrible jokes when you first come into the
show.
Like, we knew he'd do a great job with that. We knew Kelly O'Donnell would do a great job of being, you know, the really by the book woman who runs the lie detector. So we were able to draw heavily from our theater crowd, many of whom have audio experience, particularly because a lot of actors supplement their income by doing audiobooks. Then in terms of production, my other longtime collaborator, Sean Williams, who's actually married to Jordana, Sean, for many years, was a music producer.
Right.
As a producer of children's educational music. So he knew how to come on board and produce the show because, you know, I had done The Message in Life After with Panoply, and those were really big budget productions because they were co-produced by General Electric.
Yes.
And you know, so I wasn't able to necessarily retain the personnel from those productions because Steel the Stars was a much more homegrown, homespun, you know, production. So Sean handled sort of overseeing the producing of the show. And then we had a wonderful sound designer named Bart Fassbender, who does a lot of sound design for plays. He put together the final sound design on each of the episodes. We recorded the entire show in Sean and Jordana's basement in Astoria, Queens. We were recording with another writer recently who liked Steal the Stars, and we brought her into their Sean and Jordana's basement to record a piece that she wrote. We walked in, we showed her this little room, and we said, all of Steal the Stars was recorded in this room, every last bit of it. And she was kind of agog. She was like, oh my God, it's like such an epic story. It's hard to believe it was all. But I mean, we basically just reconfigured the mics so that we could put the actors in the right physical configuration for what they were doing. Yes. One of the first things the sound designer said early in the process, Bart Fassbender said to us, was people sound different when they're lying down. Mm-hmm. I didn't believe it until I heard it. But the script has got like four major pillow talk scenes between Dak and Matt when they're just talking about their lives, like when they're in bed together. And so he said, we need to put a mattress on the floor and I need to rig the mic so that the mics are over their heads on the mattress. He said, because people sound different when they're lying down. And he was right. Sure enough, as soon as I listened to her in headphones, it's a whole different energy. And so when Ashley and Nima recorded those pillow talk scenes, they were lying on a mattress together, talking to each other, and it created this wonderful feeling of intimacy. Boy, like, or when the characters were in a car, we arranged the chairs in the room so as if they were a car, and we put baffling on both sides to kind of confine the sound a little bit. But all of it was done in their basement room with the recording equipment, just one room over. Sean and Jordana had to send their kids upstairs to play with their grandmother, lived two floors up. And then we just recorded for as many hours as we could. Then once we got through all the proper scenes, we had to bring Ashley back for just tons of voiceover recording. Right. So much voiceover recording. it's just extraordinary how many hours of voice work she had to put into that show. Because Dak is such a central character.
I mean, as the writer in that space, so you were present at these recordings, and were you directing as well?
Jordana was the one who did most of the hands-on directing of the actors, but Sean would sometimes chime in and say, listen, we need to do another take to sound this way because that'll sound better when we're editing. And then I was sort of keeping an eye out for certain things that I wanted to be certain ways, that I thought would match the script the best, but it's a whole different process with audio. Jordana and I were used to working like we do with plays where, you do a rehearsal, you don't get the scene exactly right, but you're like, it'll get there like three rehearsals from now. Yes. We're going to work it three
so
more times.
Isn't
we'll
it?
Get it right. Yeah. And of course with audio, you got to get it right that day.
Yes.
Like you're recording that day and then you're never recording that scene again. I mean, the nice thing is that if you're not exactly sure what the best approach is to a scene, you can give yourself some options. You can do a few takes and give yourself some options to play with later. So sometimes we did that. We ended up with a couple of styles of takes and then Sean would figure out which one he liked better when he was putting together the dialogue assembly. When you're taking a group of people that had been kind of had gotten really used to working with one another to make live theater, and then you take that same group of artists and have them get together to do audio, I mean, you do retain all the camaraderie. That's great. But there definitely are growing pains because audio is such a different medium. I never stop needing to fix lines of dialogue. No matter how many times you rewrite before recording starts, and I was not able to rewrite much before recording started. We were on a very tight schedule with Steal the Stars, very tight. Tor offered us the gig in March, and we needed the first episode to go up at the beginning of August. So we worked really fast on that show. One reason I really liked to be at recording is because I'd be in the next room listening on the headphones, and I was constantly hearing lines that didn't sound right. I could jump on the microphone and tell the actors, I'm sorry, can you reword it to sound like this? It's the same thing. I discovered this in rehearsal as a playwright all the time. There's so many lines that look great on the page and they sound great in your head when you imagine them. And then they sound terrible when the actors say them out loud. Because good actors are like truth serum. When you can hear the actor trying to think of a way to make the line work, that means you, the writer, screwed up.
That means
you need to fix that line. It was the same with Life After. And my general feeling is whenever I can be there for an audio project, I absolutely will be. Because I prefer that. It's just not always possible.
To keep on that difference, really, between your stage writing experience and your audio writing, I've got a question from Nate Dufour. We've covered a little bit of it, but he loves you. Yeah. I think it's declared. There you go. I'd love to hear his thoughts on differences between writing for the stage and for audio, his role in casting, when we've looked a little bit at that already, and your working relationship with the directors, and then what have the inspirations been for your last three series. So let's focus first on the difference with writing for stage and audio. What do you put into or take out of your audio scripts that you do or don't have in a theatrical one?
All three of the audio dramas that I've had come out, because of the fact that all three of them were created with like a big name partner, either General Electric or Tor Publishing, they were able to reach a large number of people, and it creates a feeling like I'm this old hand at audio, but in point of fact, the three audios of mine that everybody's heard are the only three I've ever written. So I am very much a beginner who's like, I'm learning right in front of the entire podcast community. I'm learning how to write audio right in front of everyone who listens to the stuff that I write. And so I've kind of had to like learn on the job to a certain extent. Whereas with theater, I've been writing plays for virtually my entire life. I've been writing plays since I was a small child. And the fact that I've spent the last couple of years learning to write in other media has been really quite difficult. Mm-hmm. I've written some screenplays. I've written some television pilots. And most importantly to me, and I've written these audio dramas. I was really surprised at how many things I had to learn afresh in those other media. With audio, the biggest thing was what I learned in theater over the years is that theater, on one level, is the art of like writing extended conversations that build in tension as they go along. Since you're not doing a lot of quick cuts, a lot of editing, a lot of plays are generally comprised of 7, 8, 9, 10 minute scenes where people are talking, and you want to figure out how to make an extended conversation a funny and suspenseful thing to experience. With audio, dialogue and conversation is very important in a way that makes it similar to playwriting. But unlike with a play, that conversation is going to be experienced in a play. The conversation is going to be experienced by an audience of people all sitting in the same room together. On an audio drama, you know very little about how your story is going to be experienced. It's going to be experienced by people washing the dishes, driving a car, riding on the bus, riding on a
Route
train.
Route 66 on one of those big bikes. Yes.
There's a huge, and you're telling that story to one person. Your show may get hundreds of thousands of downloads, but each individual experience of the story is nearly always happening with one person. I mean, there's a couple exceptions to this. I know this one couple that they listen to audio dramas together at the dinner table. They play them out loud. But by and large, most people I know listen to audio dramas on earbuds or headphones, and it's an experience of one. So you are telling a story in someone's ear.
Yes.
And that's a much more intimate experience. So the dialogue needs to be kind of remixed for that new kind of interaction. Because you're not trying to win an audience over, you're trying to win a single listener over, and you are right next to that listener. You are in their head, rather than in a play, you're sort of declaiming from the stage and trying to get people to come over and pay attention to you. In audio drama, you are in a deeply intimate clasp with the listener. You are in their ear. And so you've got to kind of modulate the storytelling with that in mind. And a big part of it is, the thing that people talk about, which is like, how do you explain what the visuals are? And then there's that age-old joke, the visuals are better on radio. you've got to describe some things. You've got to explain what's visually happening in an audio story. But the trick is to not explain too much. What you want to do is get the listener to autofill for you. Tell a little bit about what's happening visually, but then stop. Tell just enough so that the listener fills out the image in their own mind. The image of what Moss the alien looks like with the moss on his chest. I describe Moss just well enough so that people can imagine him, and the listener's imagination is your most powerful tool as an audio dramatist.
Yes.
You are partnering with your listener's imagination. You are giving them, you're giving them the start of an image. They're going to finish, they're going to fill out the image inside their mind, and the version of Moss that they see inside their mind is way more vivid than anything you can describe. And then, of course, there's lots of little technical things. I mean, like one thing, like John Dryden, who directed Life After, he's a veteran audio drama director. He's been doing it for a long time. And you know, he just straight up told me, he's like, Mac, you need to have the characters addressing each other by their name a lot.
A couple of times, like, to get used to.
Like, even if it feels awkward, because, like, you know, in a play, you don't constantly want to be going like, could you please go get that medicine, Tom? Because everybody knows that that's Tom. You don't have to keep putting the word Tom in the lines of dialogue. In audio, you really need to put the word Tom in the line of dialogue a lot. The audience needs to be oriented to who's talking to who. And then whenever you go into a new scene, you need to think of some way of orienting the audience very fast. The current script I'm working on does not have a narrator.
Oh, so there's no narrator at all. See, that's been something that's come up quite a few times, actually, how to tell a story sans narrateur, you know, without a narrator. And podcasts with less narration would be welcomed, and less found tape kind of device would be welcomed, and less lone voice in the middle of nowhere.
And it's very rare that an American podcast drama isn't purporting to be the recording found left over from blah, 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 or whatever. We definitely seem to have a need here in the United States to constantly be saying, here's the explanation for why you're hearing a story. On UK audio drama, which is quite different in that it's a tradition that has developed in an unbroken way since radio, you know, there was never a... audio drama is just an ongoing thing that nobody thinks is weird because of the popularity of podcasts. There's this, I think we still haven't gotten used to the idea that you can just hear an audio drama and there doesn't need to be any reason for why you're hearing people talking. The lessons I've learned about writing audio, it's really important to orient people at the beginning of every scene. And I think I always recommend to people starting off that they use some kind, they use some version of narrator, because that's the fastest way to orient the audience at the beginning of every scene. In terms of orienting the audience without a narrator, in terms of establishing setting, a big, I mean, part of it is, you know, the sound designer later on will create a cool aural environment that will kind of give some clues. But then the trick is, like, is there any way to get people to talk about where they are without overtly talking about where they are? I just wrote a scene a couple days ago where two characters meet up. It's a real staple here in the United States, is like these kind of gas station rest stops. So I had two characters meeting up in a location like this. So one character's already there. He's already sitting down. The other character, the woman, she comes in. So the first thing I have her say is, she comes in, she goes, oh, there you are. Do you want chips? Do you want jerky? And he says, no, I'm fine. I don't want anything. And she goes, I definitely want jerky. And I it doesn't matter how bad it is, I always get the jerky at these places. And so I have her buy the jerky, the beef jerky, and then she sits down at the table and they start having the conversation. And it's like, so to me, like, that was a thing that I could imagine her saying when she walked into that store, that's better than her saying, how wonderful that we find ourselves inside this gas station cafe. Some horrible line of dialogue like that. When one character pulls a gun on the other. This happens in so many audio dramas, and every writer has tried a different way of grappling with how do you establish that one character is pointing a gun to the other. Pulling a gun out of your pocket and pointing it at someone doesn't make a distinctive sound. Both of the characters can see the gun. So it doesn't make sense for the one character to say to the other, "You're pointing a gun at me," or for the or the gun holder to say, "I'm pointing a gun at you." Neither one of them need to say that because they're both looking at the gun. Oh, how interesting! A Luger. How interesting! A Luger. I prefer the a 32 myself, or where on earth were you hiding that gun? Anything you could think of to let the listener know that one of them's holding a gun, other than "You're holding a gun," which just sounds terrible and false.
Yeah.
That's the never-ending challenge of audio drama, is how do you get characters to remark on visuals that the audience needs to know about?
I'm writing something where a knife is pulled out, and it's just that question of, okay, can we get the sheen of the knife out of a knife block? Would that be enough of an indication? Or do they have to say, "Put the knife," or "Put that down," or whatever? Yeah, so it's exciting as to how, yes, you need to make your audience aware of what's in your head, because I write quite visually and envisage these places, people and things. I have the faces of my characters, I have the environment they're in, and even smidgens of colour and this, that and the other. And so, yeah, it is making sure that you're not just having that in your head and not conveying elements of that through the dialogue or the action, the sound.
Smartphones did audio drama a huge disservice, because when flip phones were all the rage, if a flip phone at least kind of made an identifiable sound.
Yes.
But smartphones don't make any... When you take a smartphone out of your pocket and make a call, there's no noise that it makes. You've lost that beautiful flip that used to be able to keep listeners that someone's pulled their phone out and is making a call.
Well, yeah, I just have final questions, really. For Richard Brooks and Andy Wardlaw kind of were saying the same thing. They'd be looking at... I'd be really interested in how the book or podcast connection goes. Does the podcast enhance sales or cannibalise it? And Andy Wardlaw was saying, I'm guessing the novelisation was a way to monetize the podcast, and the podcast is almost an ad for the book. Is that right?
I assume Tor was hoping for revenue from three different sources. One is the ad revenue on the podcast itself. Another was revenue on the novelization. And then a third would be revenue on the commercial-free e-bundle with the bonus features that's out now. In terms of monetizing the project, I assume that they were hoping for revenue streams from all three of those sources. I think the aspect of the novelization, I think part of it was, to kind of make it feel like something that a book publishing company would do. They want to get into the world of podcasts. But I think part of tying it into their world was we're going to have the podcast, and we're also going to have a novelization for it, because I think, you know, they're on not just as a monetary thing, but it's also they're on just much more comfortable ground with editing and prepping and publishing a novel. And, when they first presented the project to us, you know, I went in for a meeting with them along with Sean Williams, my co-producer, and Nat Cassidy, who played Lloyd and who wrote the novelization. That was the three of us who went in for this meeting. And they said, okay, we'd like you to do the show. We'd like blah, blah, blah. They said, we sent them several ideas, and the one they picked was Steal the Stars. So they said, so Mac, since that was your pitch, we'd like you to write it. And then they said, if you want, you can write the novelization. Otherwise, we've got plenty of writers here at Tor. But Nat, has written a fair amount of prose in his life. I said, do you want us to put you forward as somebody who would do it? And they were like, we will totally consider Nat, but we need to see sample chapters from him. So he wrote a couple of sample chapters of Steal the Stars, and they were very positive on them. And so he got the gig to write the novel, which was enormously helpful because Nat was also acting in the show, and he was at every single recording. Whenever he wasn't acting, he was in the other room on the headphones listening to every take and making suggestions. He's got a really keen set of ears for that sort of stuff. Because he worked so closely on the project, and the novel was going to be published right after the last episode aired. So he had to work really fast on the novel. So every time I did a rewrite and changed the plot, I was like, oh my God, I just made Nat's life miserable. Nobody gives your script quite as close a read as someone who's trying to turn it into a novel.
Well, there you go, folks. Collaboration is key.
So he would be going through it, and he'd be turning stuff into fiction, and then he'd be like, I can't figure out how this works. This doesn't seem to make sense. So he'd email me and say, I'm having a hard time adapting this part. Now I need to rewrite that, which means you will need to rewrite. So you're welcome. there was a lot of that sort of thing going on. But the cool thing was, I wanted the novel to be in his voice, be his artistic aesthetic. And I wanted a situation where people who experience both, people who listen to the podcast and then read the book or vice versa, I wanted them to have different experiences. And that did stick pretty closely to the plot of the podcast, but a lot of it is his own flavor. And then the way that he depicted the very ending, his stylistic approach to that scene was very different from mine. In a way that feels like his is very alien. His is very much from the point of view of the alien. That wrote the whole last chapter sort of from the point of view of the alien consciousness merging with Dax. So it's got a whole different stylistic feel.
No.
Which I just loved, you know. I loved that there would be a couple different kinds of ways of telling this story.
Would you recommend that as a kind of collaboration alongside your podcast? Do you think that's been helpful to you enhancing the work? I guess it has, regarding your plot developments and so on.
I think having a situation exactly like that is probably pretty rare. I mean, in terms of like somebody novelizing. I mean, I guess in movies that happens a lot, but having somebody novelize while you write a script is unusual enough that it's hard to it's hard to recommend, just because I don't. It just wouldn't happen very often. It was definitely enormously helpful to have somebody who was basically thinking as hard about the script as I was, because he was sort of writing it right next to me. In theater, a lot of times they'll have, a dramaturg who will work with the playwright on developing the script. And I've always thought I wouldn't want a dramaturg. It sounds kind of creepy. Like, I didn't think I'd want somebody up in my creative process that much. But I have to say, working with Nat on Steal the Stars, it was really cool to have somebody, the way Jordana put it, she said, Nat is essentially writing a 250-page term paper on your script, 350-page term paper on your script while you're writing it. So it was an enormously helpful resource to have somebody who was going as deep as I was.
With regards to the writers that are listening, could you kind of give any final tips for motivation and just getting it done and just getting it out there and cracking on? Come on, what do people need to do, Mac?
Well, the biggest things for me are, I mean, the biggest thing for me is the total cliche that so many writers say, but it's a cliche because it's true, which is just get first draft done, no matter how terrible it is. I've found myself in situations where I was cursing a line of dialogue while I was writing it. Like, while I was hitting the keys, I was saying, this is garbage, this is garbage, this is garbage. Just get it to where you have a thing that you can change. Mm-hmm. Just get it to where you have a thing that you can share with your trusted colleagues. Just get it to the point where you can believe it's a real script. Like, don't fall into the trap of, like, you know, writing a chapter, writing a scene, and then rewriting it endlessly. Then beyond that, I hate to recommend this because a lot of writers have told me they don't outline and they've been successful. But generally speaking, I think outlining is really great, really important. And then you should treat outlining as more than just like a perfunctory chore that you do before you start writing the script. Treat the outline as a huge part of the process. Don't start the script until you're happy with the outline. A lot of the war is won or lost in the outline, because having, like, crossing off parts of the outline that you finished writing,
yes,
so you can see how much you've done, how much is left to go
with a knife.
it's like crossing items off a to-do list. It is such a satisfying thing to do right early in the day before you start letting a lot of the world clutter up your head. And then ultimately, nothing is quite as valuable as the friends, colleagues, like artistic confidants who will look at your script and react to it. But cultivating the right group of people who give you good feedback, who they don't coddle you. They don't tell you everything is good. Mm, but by the same token, they also don't sabotage you. Cultivating the people who will react honestly and productively to your scripts and give you good thoughts that you can work with. Yeah. Building up that circle of people in your life is incredibly valuable. And it takes time. It takes a bit of trial and error. But it should absolutely be a priority for every writer. And then the last thing I would say is whatever your particular writing form is, get some stuff out into the world, even if it isn't perfect stuff. The plays I wrote, I was never able to get any attention from the institutional theater world. I never had a script accepted by a big theater, but I self-produced a lot of my plays with friends of mine, and that started to give me a reputation. The science fiction plays that got me the attention of Tor so we could do Seals of the Stars, those are plays nobody else would have produced. They're plays about aliens taking over the world. Because my colleagues believed in them, but no institutional theater would have believed in them. We just did them, and we put them up with what money we could scrounge. Superb. I would say get your stuff out to the world. Get your stuff out there. Get people reacting to it. Even if some of it doesn't work, if you put something out in front of the world and you're humiliated because it doesn't work, that humiliation is like a graduate school education.
Yes.
That humiliation, you will learn from that more than you will learn from anything else. Get your stuff out there and make a name for it. Even if you're learning right in front of the world, do it anyway.
I want to go now and finish mine. I really do. No, that's superb. Well, huge, massive thanks very much indeed, and a long string of other words meaning that, for having a chat. We've been on for a while, and I so appreciate all the advice and the nuggets you've given. So happy writing, happy creating, and I hope you continue to make such amazing stories in this crazy world, because we do need fabulous stories, and I do feel you're a fantastic writer, so keep it up, sir.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much for having me on the show. This
you're
has been a pleasure.
You're very welcome. Well, hopefully we'll talk to you again one day. Take care. Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
So if that doesn't inspire you to just jump off this listening train right now and go and make something out of your brain onto a laptop, paper, or whatever method you write with these days, or dictate into your iPhones or whatever you do, just go and do it. Go on. Well, listen to this first, 'cause this is very important, actually. So just wait one more minute, because I do need you to, firstly, just check on our Facebook group this week for the announcements about which of the many scripts submitted to the ADPP scriptwriting competition are very shortly going to be put into production by, oh my goodness, our wonderful, amazing production houses. Huge thanks to every single person who's got involved in that. And also to our winning scripts, hooray. And thank you so much to all of those who submitted. It was really fantastic to have such an array, so we might well do it again. And the live ADPP show that we did with the three winning live show scripts will be out next month or so. That's to be confirmed, but you will hear it. It's very exciting. And if I may say, if that wasn't exciting enough, we have a shiny brand new ADPP competition to announce today. Oh yes, we do. Our ADPP Bombs Always Beep sound design competition for actual Use It and Hold It prizes is launched today. So it's inspired by the amazing Casey Wayland and Matthew Boudreau's love of all things awesome sound design, and we are launching this today. So listen carefully, as these are the rules, and this is your quest should you decide to accept it. Number one, using any sound design skills you like, create a short sound effect of an explosion. Bonus consideration if unusual sounds, brackets, cows, coffee grinders, clanging pans, close brackets, are used. Bonus considerations if we can tell what is being exploded. For example, a building, a car, a marshmallow man, your pants. No, that's not appropriate. Number two, the effect can last anything up to 30 seconds. So, decide how to create this utilising your innovation and creativity. Do the build-up of scene setting if you like, or focus on the explosion or aftermath, or, to be honest, whatever you like. It's up to you, you're making it. So just be innovative and have fun. Go on, have fun, I dare you. As number three, submit a Dropbox link containing the WAV file to our Audio Drama Network site with the following title. And this will all be written on our Facebook and Twitter pages, so if you can't get it from what I'm saying, have a look there next. So the title would be BAB, as in bombs always beep, _ your name, _ your original bomb effect name that you've given it. For example, for me, I would do BAB, _ Sarah Golding, _ boom banger 2000. Wah! So this website link, as I say, it will all be online on our Facebook page and Twitter and on our front page of our website. So please have a look there if you're confused. And this needs to be done by the deadline of the 15th of April 2018 by midnight EST. You also need to submit a Dropbox link containing a document listing info on how you've created that effect, what you did and how you did it. How did you make it? Step by step. So a list of sound effects, for example, that you've linked, looped, foley, whatever you've done. And just show us how you created this amazing sound effect. And prizes, number five. You can win, for first place, a copy of Bombs Always Beep by AD Guru Casey Wayland. And second place, a copy of Ubiduo's Cabin Sound Effects Pack. It's very exciting. And third prize is an ADPP live event mug and stickers. Yes. Yeah, we had some left over. How cool is that? Yeah? So the judges are absolutely amazing in their fields. We have Casey Wayland himself. We have Matthew Boudreau of All Stage Studios and, of course, the Audio Drama Network. And our next guest after this episode comes out is Ellie Maitland. And she is a Foley expert working from Wildclaw Theatre, if you didn't already know. And she is going to be our third amazing judge. So the winners will be notified via email and also by a special ADPP episode with the judges on it, and obviously on all of our social media platforms. There's an entry fee of $2 per effect entered, and that's paid over PayPal or via the Audio Drama Network site. We'll find a link, as I say, online. Don't panic. This fee goes towards the Audio Drama Network in conjunction with Oral Stage Studios and ADPP producing the script Don't Let Your Mind Wander, which was written by Richard Brooks. We love you, Richard, for the ADPP scriptwriting competition. And if any money's left over, we'll help fund cool prizes for future ADPP competitions, of which we would like there to be many. So please enter, because it would be marvellous to keep this ball rolling. So get cracking, ticking, beeping, or exploding. And thank you all. Oh, and obviously, just to finish the episode properly, thank you so much to everybody at the Audio Drama Network for helping us to get these episodes up and out to you. And of course, the wonderful Tanya Milojevic for editing this fun-packed writing episode. And Mac Rogers, just absolutely outstanding. And I hope you've enjoyed him sharing his talent, inspiration and time with us. So happy creating all. Either get writing or get designing. Lots for you to do. Get cracking on our competitions, why don't you? Goodbye.
Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.